call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3 p.m. or 3:30 p.m. on Monday, April 1st, 2019. No kidding. April 1st, 2019. Present are Vice Chair Coghill, Senator Geisel, Senator Reinbold, Senator Kawasaki, and myself, Chairman Birch, and Senator Keel. Senator Bishop is excused. Please silence your cell phones, and I would just note that we have one item on today's agenda. It's a presentation by the Department of Fish and Game. We originally scheduled this presentation in anticipation of a Supreme Court ruling on the John Sturgeon case. And although Sturgeon dealt primarily with navigable waters, the court's ruling had the potential to impact Alaska's dual federal-state system of subsistence use management. The court's ruling was handed down last week and was a clear win in terms of Alaska's right to manage navigable waterways. However, the court's decision steered clear of fish and game management issues. Nevertheless, particularly in light of Wednesday's pending discussion on a bill relating to competing uses of the state's limited resource of big game, I thought the committee would still benefit from an overview of fish and game management and how the department and the boards of fisheries and game work together to ensure fair allocation and management of the state's limited resources. Today, we're happy to have Fish and Game Commissioner Designee Doug Vincent Lang to walk us through that process. Commissioner, please state your name and title for the record, and you're welcome to proceed. Thanks for joining us.
Mr. Chair, my name is Doug Vincent Lang, Commissioner Designee for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today. I was able to put this together on my long plane ride back from Washington, D.C. on Friday, so hopefully there's not too many typos in it. So we're going to talk to you a little bit about how fish and game is managed in the state of Alaska. Hopefully I haven't simplified this because I know you have a lot of experience with it and understand it pretty good, but it was a good refresher course for me, too, to go through the books and figure out where we were. So fish and game management in the state of Alaska is basically founded in the state's constitution. In Article 8, Natural Resources, it's got basically five sections in it that really deal with fish and game management. One is, Section 1 says, there's a policy of maximum use of our fisheries resources consistent with public interest. That basically says to me that resources are a public trust resource. They're not mine, they're not yours, they belong to the public, and we're supposed to manage them for their maximum use, not just let them sit on the sideline and be out there like a national park. Section 2 says it grants the authority to you, the legislature, to provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of natural resources for the maximum benefit of the people. So it clearly identifies the legislature's role in resource management, including fish and game management. Section 3 says wild fish, wildlife, and waters are reserved to the people for common use. Section 4, fish and wildlife resources shall be utilized, developed, and maintained on the sustained yield principle, subject to preferentials amongst beneficial uses. This is the first time we actually talk about sustained yield. There's a common misperception out there that it's maximum sustained yield. It's maximum benefit, but it's sustained yield. And that means we're supposed to sustain these populations for future generations. We're just not taking them for today's generation. Then finally, Section 17 says laws governing disposals of natural resources shall apply equally to all persons similarly situated with reference to the subject matter and purposes served by laws and regulations. So there's really three entities that are tied into fish and game management. One is the legislature, which was clearly outlined in that constitution. Second is the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game. And the third is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Each has a distinct role in enacting the constitutional authorities that I just described in the previous slide. But probably, perhaps most importantly, the public engages with each one of these entities. I thought about putting four entities on here, but really the public is an umbrella over all three of these different ones. They elect you, and they expect you to represent them. They through the governor's office, who's an elected official, and through your confirmation processes, we have the Boards of Fisheries and Games, and through the confirmation process, and the governor again, selecting a nominee, you have a voice in the direction of how fish and game agencies run. So you delegated to the boards certain authorities. The first one is 1605-221, which is the Board of Fisheries and Board of Game are created by the legislature, and all powers and authorities are derived from statute, which you clearly and you again have a role in. established for the conservation and development of fish and game resources. 1605221, the boards have regulation-making powers. They're quasi-legislative, but they don't have any administrative, budgeting, or fiscal powers. Those lie with the executive branch, the governor's office, and fish and game. 1605251 and 255 sets out regulation-making authority. They basically can create regulations. They have the authority to do 5AAC 16, and there's all kinds of, five AEC regulations in the book, and there are many regulations in that book that govern fisheries and hunting. The boards have the power and duties to enact regulations regulating hunting and fishing and subsistence fishing and hunting as needed for the conservation, development, and utilization of the fish and game resources, again, in the public interest. And in 1605258, the board shall identify fish and game populations that are customarily and traditionally used for subsistence and determine the amounts of harvestable surpluses reasonably necessary for subsistence. I'll get a little bit more into subsistence later in this talk. The boards also have the authority to delegate certain authorities to the Fish and Game Commissioners, and they do it. I just gave a couple examples here. One is petitions for emergency regulations in case they can't meet or there's a need to take an emergency action. Waterfowl regulations is another one. And then you've delegated authorities to the ADF&G commissioner. In 1605060, you've delegated me emergency order authority to open and close seasons or areas and to change weekly close periods on fish and game by means of emergency order. And in 1605-0203, I have an implied authority to adopt regulations to implement the authorities that you've granted me. So how does this all work? In the real world, ADF&G determines sustained yields for populations and stocks. So we're getting back to the constitutional authority, sustained yield. I do that through running stock assessment program and working for those stocks that go outside state of Alaska jurisdiction, federal and international cooperation. So we determine what a population looks like, how big it is, what's a manageable unit, and then we try to determine what the sustained yield is and what the harvestable surplus of that population is. Then the boards step in and they determine allocation and management plans for surplus yields. So there's a board process. Again, there's two boards. There are seven-member boards. They're appointed by the governor, confirmed by you. And they basically deliberate on proposals from the public to manage those surplus yields and how those surplus yields should be allocated between user groups. There's an advisory committee process that's governed by the Open Meetings Act. And that process is basically, there's 70 some of those across the state of Alaska. They've been established to inform the board process as they deliberate on proposals. They determine whether a proposal from their expertise as local users in the community, those proposals should be adopted, not adopted, or amended somehow. And then there's public participation, both through the advisory committee process and through the board process. So it really is a public process how they adopt regulations governing the use of those resources in their best interest. Again, coming back to that public trust doctrine. Then, after that's done, ADF&G uses the emergency order authority that you've granted to the commissioner to implement those management plans. So we're opening and closing hunts and fisheries based on those management plans that have been adopted by the board. And then finally, ADF&G uses its emergency order authority to close fisheries and hunts to ensure long-term sustainability. So, for instance, I used my emergency order authority to close the Northern Cook Inlet King Salmon fisheries this year because we were not projecting to meet even minimum escapement goals. So we opted to go outside the management plans and close those fisheries to protect long-term viability. Is it working? I love this slide. I think it is. I think, you know, our sustainable management of fish and wildlife resources means about $11 billion in economic value to the state. Commercial fisheries about $5 billion, sport fishing about $2 billion. Wildlife about $4.6 billion, and we're returning a lot of investment back into the subsistence resources. And I think most important, the public has a real role in how these fisheries and hunts are managed.
Great. Commissioner, do you want to take questions as we go through?
Or? Either way.
Okay.
Sir? Just a really brief one on the emergency order concept. I mean, when I hear emergency, it's sort of something that just came up as opposed to something that we know is coming. And it seems like I don't have any statistical data, but just anecdotally, it seems like there's a lot more emergency orders than I've seen in the past.
Yeah, I would say that is a nomenclature issue. It's an emergency order because that's the way it's been delegated to us by statute. But really what they are is fishery orders or hunting orders. Basically, we're issuing an order to comply with a management plan that's been adopted. Very rarely is it an emergency. In certain cases it is, but most often they're more complying with the regulatory regimes that we've been asked to manage with.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, proceed.
Thanks. So let's talk a little bit about subsistence. I know that we were getting ready for the sturgeon case last week, and that's what I started with before I came to that first part. So subsistence is a state priority. It has a priority under state law, AS 1605258, and all Alaskans, regardless of their residency, do have a subsistence priority in the state. And Alaska has a meaningful mechanism in place to ensure subsistence needs of our citizens are being met. 1605258 gives a priority to the use of all fish and game that are customary and traditionally used for subsistence. And it requires that the boards identify all fish and game populations and portions thereof that are customarily and traditionally taken and used for subsistence. And it also tells the boards that if a portion of a population can be harvested consistent with sustained yield, the board shall determine the amount of the harvestable portion that is reasonably necessary for subsistence. So it brings in that first criteria of not only is it stock used customary and traditionally, how much of that stock goes to subsistence. Then finally, it must provide a reasonable opportunity for subsistence, defined as an opportunity that provides a normally diligent person with a reasonable expectation of success. So there's three steps. They first look at the population, they determine whether or not it provides for a customary and traditional use. Then it determines how much of that population above the sustained yield surplus is used for customary and traditional purposes. And then it provides a reasonable opportunity to go out and harvest that amount that they identified. They also have in statute, if the harvestable portion of the population is not sufficient to provide for a reasonable opportunity for subsistence uses, the board shall adopt regulations eliminating consumptive uses for other subsistence and distinguishing among subsistence users based on specific criteria. So in certain cases, like up in Norton Sound, where we don't have enough salmon that goes to meet the needs of all Alaskan subsistence users, the board does have in place a mechanism and criteria to allow for a select group of subsistence users to harvest those fish with a priority. They also have the ability to establish non-subsistence use areas. So under 5 AEC 99015, the joint boards may establish non-subsistence areas. And those are defined as an area or community where dependence upon subsistence is not a principal characteristic of the economy, culture, or way of life of the community. And currently, there are four of those. There's the Anchorage, Matsu, Kenai Peninsula non-subsistence area, the Fairbanks non-subsistence use area, the Valdez non-subsistence use area, the Juneau and the Ketchikan non-subsistence use areas. I guess there's five. Okay. So how does this work? Again, bringing back to how we do it as the agency. First, the board considers a proposal. They have a proposal in front of them regarding a fishery. They look at whether or not there's customary and traditional use of those of that population that's being affected by that proposal, and then determine whether or not the amounts necessary for subsistence are being provided for. They basically, in making that decision, get input from the public and advisory committees, and then the board determines whether reasonable opportunity exists. If it exists, then they'll go on with that proposal and adopt it. If they don't determine it exists, they'll amend that proposal to ensure that that reasonable opportunity is going to occur for subsistence users. So where are they found? They're found in regulation 5AC01, and basically the board's customary and traditional findings are in regulation as well as the amounts necessary for subsistence. Now the federal subsistence program, that's a little bit different. Federal subsistence board has three public members. It has four agency members, the BIA, BLM, US Fish and Wildlife Service, and National Park Service. And then it has liaisons that include all of the RACs, which are regional advisory committees, and the ADF&G commissioner. There are non-voting members. The regional advisory committees are FACA committees, so they get input from the public through the FACA process. And the role of the state is strictly an advisory role. We don't have a vote on the federal advisory board, but we can comment on proposals that affect, that could potentially affect the state. So under their process, they basically are stating that except as otherwise provided in this act and other federal laws, the taking on public lands of fish and wildlife for non-wasteful subsistence uses shall be accorded a priority or the taking of such lands for fish and wildlife for other purposes. So clearly subsistence has a priority, just like under state. Whenever it is necessary to restrict the taking of populations of fish and wildlife on such lands for subsistence uses in order to protect the continued viability of such populations or to continue such uses, such priority should be implemented through various criteria. One is the customary and direct dependency upon the populations as the mainstay of livelihood, local residency, and the availability of alternative resources. So this is where you get local residency. This is where the rural preference comes into play.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Can you tell me a little bit about the interplay between, I mean, we know that moose don't stop at the end of a management unit in state. They move and migrate. The interplay between how that works between state and federal land and then in the individual management units. Can you tell me that?
Complex. It's a very complex question through the chair. Basically an animal when it's taken on federal land has a rural preference. When it's taken on state land, it's eligible for everybody. So that's why we should be talking to each other on the management of those resources to ensure we're protecting sustained yield. Because at the bottom of each one of these things is a sustained yield principle.
Okay.
Senator Cockfield?
Except for the federal government doesn't have a sustained yield principle.
They say basically that you have to ensure for viability of populations, conservation of principle. You're right, they don't have a sustained yield mandate, but they have a conservation mandate.
Other questions? Seeing none? Thank you. Proceed.
So what are the main differences? Under the state process, you have a C&D determination coupled with an amount necessary for subsistence determination. Under the federal process, you have a customary and traditional use determination, but you don't have an A&S determination. So you don't determine how much of that stock is supposed to go towards subsistence uses, nor do you have an assessment of reasonable opportunity. So you're missing important targets under that federal system to assess whether or not you're meeting subsistence needs. So it becomes a very qualitative assessment rather than a quantitative assessment like it is under the state system. So the Federal Subsistence Board process is also somewhat different. It has a call for proposals similar to the Board of Fish and Board of Game process. It goes undergo a federal staff review. Then they have regional advisory committee reviews, kind of like the our advisory committee review process. Then they have an interagency staff committee review, which is basically the federal agencies reviewing those proposals and weighing in from their agency perspective, similar to how Fish and Game informs the Board of Game. Then they have a Federal Subsistence Board meeting, publish the final rules. And in this case, different from the state system, there is an opportunity to reconsider their decisions based on a request for reconsideration. So with that, I'll close. And I think it was interesting for me to put this presentation together, go through the reg book and find out how we're doing things and not doing things. But I want to leave you with the impression that I think fish and game management is working well in the state of Alaska. I think we're doing a good job in conserving our stocks. We have trouble with some king salmon stocks, but I don't think it's a management failure as much as it is a ecological failure in those cases. We have many opportunities for public participation in the process, something that I think is really important. I think we have a better system for public participation than many other states across the union do. And in terms of state subsistence, we take that subsistence priority seriously. We have a state subsistence priority. We have a mechanism in place to quantify what that use is, and we have a regulatory process in place to ensure that that's being met.
Senator, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Reinbold, question?
Well, just interesting, at 3:35, four different fish people were released for the Board of Fish from the governor, and then three from game. So I just got that today. So I thought that was kind of coincidental timing. I was just reviewing them right now. But what I was going to ask you is public safety. We didn't talk in regards to that. That's a big issue. I know in my area in Eagle River, there's tons of bears, tons of moose. I could go on and on and on. I think it's more broad. Where's your role in regards to public safety?
Well, it's one of the factors that the Board of Game considers, and it's one of the factors that I consider. So, for instance, in Anchorage, I know that we went on the record this last time when they were discussing bear harvest opportunities in Cook Inlet in the Anchorage area to actually increase the harvest opportunities to take a few of those bears out. And in my role, I think, is to factor in public safety. So we are actually removing bears that are public safety concerns in the Anchorage area. So it factors in, as long as it doesn't affect the conservation of the bear population.
The chair, one more.
Follow up.
Okay, so I mean, it is a serious issue in regards to trails, wildlife, all that. I've wanted to do a bill, I think, for 6 years now in regards to management of wildlife inside the municipalities. You know, like that area is green, managed for public safety, and then you step out from that, and yellow is more, kind of at risk, and then the red zone is, hey, you're on your own, you know, you're out at your cabin or whatever. So is there any new policies, knowing that, I mean, bears are attacking people on the way up to my neighborhood? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a bear killed in my friend's back, a bear killed a human being in my friend's backyard last year. I mean, is there anything new you're seeing, or any other rights? Because when we called Fish and Game, when we used to call Fish and Game, everyone pretty much quit calling them, because Jesse Coltrane would say, if there's one piece of paw print in that yard, I'm going to fine you. And here they had little kids. They couldn't get into the cars, but there was a bear roaming around, and they were going to get fined if they called Fish and Game. So it became a massive issue in my district, where they were scared to death to call Fish and Game. And I ask for all the green slips, you know, those green slips for reporting wildlife, because I used to hang out at Fish and Game all the time, and to see what the public safety risk. Are you guys doing anything with them? Is there any type of, kind of like Crime Watch? I mean, just like wildlife watch, so people can be aware. There's a lot of new military families moving in and out, and some of them are so scared that they literally put film on their windows because the bears, you know, that house that got broken into by a bear last year. Anyway, I guess bottom line is just public safety. What are you doing for public safety? How can we increase awareness on the trails and in the homes? And what exactly are you guys doing in regards to that?
Yeah, well, bears, I thought when I was the wildlife director 4 years ago that my biggest problem would be bears and villages in rural Alaska. It's not. Bears and villages stay out of villages because they get shot by villagers. I think there's a healthy fear of coming into those villages, and there's not that many problems out in those areas. But in Anchorage and some of the bigger communities, there are problems. And it's kind of a interesting perception. It is people want to live with bears and wildlife in urban areas, but they don't want it to affect their safety. So where is that line? And I bring it back to geese in Anchorage many, many years ago. You know, we used to have 2,000 geese in Anchorage, and everybody was happy. Then we got 6,000 geese in Anchorage. Population started increasing, and geese poop was on most of the playing fields and parks and everything else. Got up to about 10,000, and there were a lot more geese issues in Anchorage with not being able to go have kids playing soccer fields and everything else. So Fish and Game put management options out from ways to reduce the goose population, but nobody wanted to take those management options because it would resulting in reductions in the geese. Then an AWACS jet went down, and all of a sudden, all those management options that were outside the sphere of acceptable options for the community became acceptable. And so we went out and started removing eggs from nests from goose nest, and got that population back down to 3,000 to 4,000 range. But it takes people's willingness to accept those management options to get to a level that they become acceptable. I think we're getting closer to that in Anchorage. I think people are voicing concerns. We had a fatality last year, and then we had an attack for somebody going to look for that person, that the bear that looked for that person that died. We're removing more bears as an agency that are problem bears, and we provided more hunting opportunities. Are we going to remove all the bears in Anchorage? Probably not, because there's not going to be public acceptance for that. But we're going to become more willing to deal with what considered are the problem bears.
Okay, one more question, Mr.
Follow up.
Okay, so people like to say, and a lot of people haven't been here forever, that it's because the trash is being left out. Mm-hmm. I believe it's a much bigger issue than that, because I was raised here, and we used to set garbage bags at the end of, and we never saw a bear ever, my whole life, growing up. And there was an area, in the city limit. Is there any thought of bringing any of those type of management things back from what we did in the 80s? I know there was a dramatic shift in the 90s. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be a huge issue in about a week or two in my area, and that's why I'm talking about right now.
I get it. We're kind of blessed in Anchorage. We got great habitat up our salmon streams, but we got salmon. Salmon are a draw to bears, and we have a lot of forested areas in Anchorage, which is drawing moose down into the Anchorage Bowl, and they're having calves, which draw bears down. Yeah, I think you're going to start seeing some successes. The board realized the issue with bears. They've heard from the public. They're liberalized bear hunting opportunities on base and in other areas of the park where they can have it. Fortunately, you can't do a lot of hunting of bears with high-powered rifles in the Anchorage populated centers itself. But in those cases where there are problem bears, we'll address that.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator Giesel.
Well, I was just going to give the commissioner the opportunity to talk about what you're doing on J-Bear. So I had a community meeting a couple weeks ago, and we invited ADF&G to come, and they presented the fact that there are 25 bear permits this year on J-Bear, I believe. Could you elaborate on that?
I was traveling when the board of game met on that, but I know that from what I know about it is we encourage them to provide additional harvest opportunities for bear, basically to address this issue. There, in the past, we were very reluctant as a staff to increase harvest opportunities on bears throughout the Anchorage Bowl and 14C. But I think now we have a better understanding of the bear population dynamics, and we've realized we can have a greater harvest rate. And that was one of the systems they did. The board adopted to do that.
Well, Commissioner, I, for one, want to say how much I appreciate the thinning out of the bear populations in the bowl. I think it's absolutely a safety issue, and your efforts and the efforts of your staff and the organization are much appreciated. A question on slide 8, and when you look at the wildlife, revenues or economic impact. Do you have a sense of resident versus non-resident? Obviously there's a lot of tourists come up here in the summer. A lot of people come up here hunting or fishing. Do you have a sense in just looking down your numbers where that breakout might be?
On the wildlife? In terms of the wildlife one, the wildlife viewing is built into that one. So there's a lot of, I think it's almost about $3 billion worth of wildlife viewing activity going on.
Okay. And that's probably largely out. Yes.
Yeah. And I can get you some specific breakdowns. I have it with this, but in terms of what's inside Alaska and what's kind of done in terms of jobs and a variety of other things for each one of those breakdowns. So we'll get you the reports for those.
Be helpful. Thank you. Question, Senator Coghill?
First of all, thank you for taking the job as commissioner. I appreciate that. And I think you've answered some good questions. One of the things that I heard just recently talking to some of our native folks is that our harvest rate per capita and per geographic location is way low compared to other places. And they're saying because we keep ourselves too close to the brow management and things like that. So help me understand, where are we doing really well and where could we do better? On mostly ungulate, the caribou and the moose population are probably the thing to get the most attention as far as I can see, outside of the fish. I know fish gets lots of attention, so but as far as the population base and the harvest rate, I've heard that places like Montana, even Maine, do a very, very different harvest number than we do. And is that a geographical problem? Is that our problem because we're so small in population, or is it even a problem?
Well, that's a question that I've actually been mulling around quite a bit in my own brain. I think part of it is we have a higher percentage of our population that's interested in hunting than some of those other states do. So they have a lower participation rate in those hunts. Number two is you know, we are very concerned about fires in the state of Alaska, especially with moose. And as such, we like to go out and put those fires out. And it'd be a lot nicer if some of those fires would actually burn in some areas, but I get the fact that we want to control fires so we don't want people's cabins burning down. But by controlling habitat, and really up until about 5-6 years ago, we were doing little to control predators, but we were harvesting ungulates. Well, if you're managing two-thirds of that ecosystem without managing predation at some point in time, you're fighting a losing battle. So I think what we got to do is provide for increased ungulate production through intensive management. And I think the Constitution requires us to actively manage our population. So you'll see me where it's appropriate to increase predator control, to increase ungulate population. The bottom line is there's a lot of people. Nelchina is a great case. You know, there's a lot of people that want to go harvest Nelchina caribou, and there's caribou that are harvestable, that have harvestable surpluses, for instance, up in the North Slope, that people aren't going to fly to. They're going to want to go to where the harvestable surplus is. We don't have a lot of roads, so people flock to the areas where the roads are, and they don't flock to the areas where the roads aren't. That's also part of the problem. So, yeah, I think we need to actively manage our populations to increase production to meet demand, but if the population were to double or triple in Alaska, it's going to be hard to meet that demand in those road-accessible areas.
Is there any other committee questions or comments? Senator Kawasaki?
Thank you. You were mentioning the management of subsistence between the federal government and the state, and like under the Clean Air and Clean Water Act, we have primacy over certain, so the state of Alaska has assumed the role of what the EPA used to do in some circumstances. Is there a federal analog to that for game, fish and game management in federal areas?
Well,
it seems to me that they were talking about something just recently about management of state management of wild fish and game resources. Maybe it was Secretary Zinke or somebody else recently.
Trying to think what you're asking. Yes, there's a, well, first off, in the Sturgeon case, the federal government ruled that the state has ownership of those navigable waterways, but they left the question of fish and game management silent in the Supreme Court decision on Sturgeon. So for the future, right now, until somebody potentially challenges that, the federal government is going to be managing fisheries in navigable waterways within the jurisdiction that the court has defined in terms of Sturgeon in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, the federal government has a role in deciding subsistence use, for instance, of animals on federal land, and they're increasingly wavering into those decisions, bringing their mandates on how fishery and wildlife stock should be managed. So, for instance, they have a conservation mandate on federal land, but they also manage for natural diversity. So, unlike the state system where we're managing for maximum use and harvestable surpluses for all Alaskans, they're managing for natural diversity, and those instances where natural diversity is going to provide some additional uses, that'll be have a subsistence will have a priority. So they're not going to manage the populations for maximum use. They're going to manage it for their natural diversity. In certain cases, there will be surplus production. In other cases, there won't.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, I would like to take this opportunity to thank you, Commissioner, for a great presentation and lending some clarity to the process. I'm also reminded by our in-house wildland fire veteran that this being April 1st, it's a statutory first day of the fire season, and burn permits are now required for any open burning. And I'm, as I look outside, you think, wow, it's yeah. Spring is here. Our next resources committee meeting will be held at 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday, April 3rd, when we'll have one item on the agenda. Senate Bill 87 to limit non-resident taking of game. We had originally had SB 51 on Wendy's agenda as well, but we postponed that hearing pending some requested legal analysis on the bill. With that, this meeting is adjourned at 4:05 p.m.